Hello, and welcome to the Oscar Went To, the podcast that looks back at a year in film and sees what films endured, what films didn't, and attempts to figure out why. Please give it up for your masters of ceremony, Max Salim and Nick Mastad.
Hello, and welcome to the Oscar Went To. It is I, Nick, again. We are sans Max for week three, I think. And we were off last week, so it's good to be talking to everyone again. And Max should be back in the next week or two. I know they just wrapped up on production of the film like a couple days ago, so I've only briefly texted with Max, and I'm excited to, as I'm sure all of you listeners are, to hear about how it went and his current mindset. Well, this week, I'm very excited. We have our first return special guest, and the movie we're talking about is a particularly good one and favorite of mine. So, without further ado, this week, as a supplement to our 2001 episode, we are getting our scuba gear on and doing a deep dive into the 2001 hit jukebox musical extravaganza Moulin Rouge, directed by Baz Luhrmann. I'm Nick Mastad. On this podcast, we like to look back at a year in film and decide what has aged well and what hasn't and try to figure out why. If that sounds interesting to you, jump back a few episodes in our feed and check out our recap of the year in film that was 2001 if you haven't already. And then after that recap, we like to jump into the depths and take a closer look at some of the films that piqued our interest from a given year. Quick disclaimer, as always, our deep dive episodes are no holds barred, and we will absolutely be getting into spoiler territory. So if you've never seen Moulin Rouge and you want to see it and then listen to this episode. Okay, without further ado, please give it up. Even if you're, just collectively give it up. I don't care if you're sitting on a subway train. I don't care if you're stuck in traffic in your car alone. I don't care if you're laying head on pillow, falling asleep. Give a round of applause for our return special guest. We love him, Mark Denny. Welcome, Mark.
Wow, thank you. Such an honor to be a return guest.
First one, inaugural. How does it feel? I guess you just said honor.
Yeah, I did just say honor. So
that's my bad. Egg on my face.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, but I did say it. But.
Yeah, you said it, and I kind of just jumped onto a platitude of what I've heard other hosts say, and now I'm paying the price.
Right.
Which is embarrassment. Mark, I am in New York and you are in San Diego.
Yes.
What's the weather like out there today?
It's a little overcast, kind of cool. Not much wind. It's overcast, I think is the answer.
Okay. I honestly, as soon as I asked the question, I thought, well, duh, it's probably sunny and 75 degrees, but to hear overcast, that's wasn't expecting that. Kind of cool.
Yeah, you know, it's a little overcast closer to the coast, and then it by the afternoon it sort of burns off.
Ooh, okay, burns off
until nice. About July or August. That's sort of the how the weather works.
Okay, got it. And then I'm assuming July and August, it's pretty much sunny all the time.
Yes. Sunny awesome. All the time.
That's great. Hopefully we can keep that going.
I global warming hope wise. So.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so Mark, do you have anything you want to, any life updates you want? Well, there is a life. I don't know if you want to share this with us. I'm just going to ask this. Do you have any life updates that you would like to share with us before we get into today's movie?
Oh, that's interesting, Nick. I actually do. In about... I still need to get all this sort of officially taken care of, but I'm going to be moving to New York very soon in about 7 to 10 days. I'm actually waiting right now. I'm going to get a notification likely during this recording whether or not my lease package has been accepted for an apartment in New York. And yeah, and then after that, I have to basically find a way to get out there in about a week. So I'm going to be moving at a pretty fast pace.
That's very exciting. If we had any sound bites, I would be playing the one that goes pew 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 pew, because that's exciting for me.
Yeah,
and New York.
Great. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's really exciting. A couple of my college friends were joking about throwing me a debutante ball, which I think would be really exciting.
Yeah. Is a debutante ball similar to a cotillion?
I only know what cotillion is because I did it in the fifth grade, and that was my experience was just sort of learning sort of etiquette and how to dance, classical sort of dances like the foxtrot and stuff, which I actually, kind of bragging now, got a trophy for. But I believe a debutante ball, I think, and I could be totally wrong, is just like a introduction to the new community or like, you know, society that you're now a part of.
And to your knowledge, is a cotillion gender specific? Like, is it just for girls, like, or is it just like a girl thing that boys attend? Or is it both sexes?
The cotillion that I did was boys and girls. For me, a debutante ball seems like it is something that would be for women, an introduction for women. You know, I'm getting a call from the leasing agent. Should I
do it?
Pick up?
Take it. We can cut this out or include it, but do your thing.
Hi, Mark. His name's Mark. Yeah, I'm sorry, what was that? I'm pretty good. How are you?
Yeah, so you're all set.
Oh, okay. So to okay, yeah, you had said give the super a day before I contact him or her.
Maybe just call him tomorrow.
Okay.
Because I
did just
drop some calls and
call him
out.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean,
we got it done. That's the right thing.
We did get it done. Okay.
Right.
Well,
so
thank
you. No problem. I'll follow up with you on your moving day to make sure that everything's okay. And I will talk to you then.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
No problem.
All right. Bye bye.
All the best.
All right. You too.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. He had described it as a pain in the ass. I'm not sure any of that audio is going to come through because it was a little fuzzy, but I was sort of wanting to get him to say that. Really a tremendous pain in the ass trying to get this lease in out of state because I needed to overnight it, and then I sent in the wrong checks. Anyway, so yeah, I have an apartment in New York City.
Okay. I mean, truly, I want to clarify to listeners that this timing was not planned, and that timing couldn't have been better in regards to being entertaining. just a quick post game recap. I mean, this wasn't a surprise based on your body language?
Well, he had thought that there was a very good chance that I would get the apartment because the office was closed through, I think, maybe even Wednesday through today, and I had sent in everything ahead of time, so there was no opportunity really for any more people to look at the apartment. But actually when I initially applied for the apartment, the floor below, and his, I was going to say his like sneaky ass or something sort of hid from me that I think I was really applying for the apartment on the fourth floor. You know, to be honest, there's an elevator, I'm a floor up above the street. I think there's a little more light, so I'm pretty excited for it. I took a virtual tour of it. It's the exact same apartment. So that was the only little sort of hiccup surprise, but I'm excited about it. Yeah.
Mark, I'm absolutely thrilled. So after we're done with this podcast, it's go time for you.
Yes, it's go time. I have to move to the city. My new job starts June 15th, and I have to get to the city very quickly.
I'm so excited, Mark. And and on behalf of our listenership, we're all excited for you.
Oh, well, thank you, everyone. I really appreciate that.
Circling back real quick to the debutante ball, I feel like that naturally segues nicely into today's movie, which is Moulin Rouge. So just to set the table, Moulin Rouge is directed by Baz Luhrmann, produced by Martin Brown, Baz Luhrmann, and Fred Barron, and written by Baz Luhrmann and Craig Pierce. It premiered at Cannes on May 9th, 2001, and then was released wide in the United States on May 16th, 2001. It holds a Rotten Tomatoes score of 76%, almost completely consistent on IMDb. It holds a 7.6 out of 10, and on Letterboxd, it holds a 3.7 out of 5. Moulin Rouge was a box office hit. It earned $179.2 million at the box office on a $50 million budget, and it was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Actress, and it won 2 Oscars for Best Costume Design and Best Art Direction. Notably, Baz Luhrmann was not nominated for Best Director on this, and we can talk about that later. Mark,
yes.
What was... Do you remember your first experience seeing this movie? What's your relationship to this movie? Tell me, set the scene for us.
I don't remember specifically the first time seeing it, but I do remember absolutely loving it. Let's see, 2001, so I would be 14. I really loved it, and it was sort of, for me, I felt like almost a secret how much I loved this movie.
Okay.
Because... I think, like, I wasn't doing theater or anything like that, and in a way that mm-hmm. I'm sort of now ashamed or embarrassed to admit, to me it felt like a sort of feminine type of movie for a 14-year-old boy to love
sure.
at the time,
sure.
at least in my sort of social circles and in my upbringing. But, I mean, I absolutely loved it. I believed in its message. I love the music. You know, I was thinking about this, and maybe we can talk more about it, but I also was probably not exposed to a lot of these songs that are sampled or used in the film. So mm-hmm. I was pretty, like, bowled over by them, like Heroes by David Bowie and all of that. So mm-hmm. I loved it, and it was a little bit of a sort of secret. But although, now that I say this, I may be completely contradicting myself, because I might have had a movie poster in my room. in which case I would have been showcasing my enjoyment of the film. So,
yeah. But were your friends often in your room?
No. So that's okay. A really good point. Yeah. So it was sort of an inner sanctuary that few people were granted access to. I mean,
sure,
some.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I feel like I did at some point have this movie poster. It could have been in college, actually. Yeah. Anyway, I guess a lot of emotions.
Yeah, no, for sure. They're kind of striking a chord with me too, because I missed this. I remember, I mean, this movie was a big presence when it came out, because there was the what's the name of the song? What was the music video? The Vous Couchez Avec Moi.
Oh, right, Lady Marmalade.
Lady Marmalade. The Lady Marmalade song and music video was like everywhere. That's what I remember upon the release. I didn't see this movie in theaters. I didn't see this movie for a couple years, and then I remember, I think it was my senior year of high school, so 2000, it'd be like spring 2005. I went to my high school girlfriend was in like the kind of dance production that my high school put on every year. It was just like all dance.
Cool.
And one of the dance numbers was to the tango, de Roxanne, what is it? El Tango de Roxanne.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, and the dance was really great, and the song, you know, obviously is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is that song from?
Mm-hmm.
And then that was like, oh, you've never seen Moulin Rouge. We have to watch Moulin Rouge. And I watched Moulin Rouge and then was like obsessed with it for like the next like 3 months. Like, had a friend like burn me, Elephant Love Medley and Your Song.
Oh, right.
El Tango de Roxanne. And I just like listened to that. This movie reminds me of end of senior year, even though that's not when this came out for me.
Cool.
But that's what I like got really, really into it. And then like definitely had the DVD in college, all this.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not. So this is a movie that I was like really super into mm-hmm. and watched many times in probably a like year to 2 year period, and have not seen or thought about it much since.
Mm-hmm. Same.
And I know when I mentioned this movie to you as like a possible candidate for this episode, you referenced a similar relationship with it, of like, have not seen it in years but loved it when it was out.
Yes, definitely. I mean, that all strikes a chord with me as well. Same sort of thing, being kind of bowled over by it. it was great. It actually, I should mention that I was fortunate to travel to Paris, and my brother and I went to the Moulin Rouge because of
wow.
this movie, and
okay.
were kind of disappointed because the movie is so extravagant and beautiful. And there I also got a poster from the Moulin Rouge.
Let's get into favorite scenes, moments. I'll start us off. I mean, first image, first sounds of this movie. I love the orchestra pit curtains, kind of warm up to 20th Century Fox logo into the opening of the movie. And it closes it out too, but the opening is like such a cool tone setter in terms of like it's just the radicalness of the style and stuff is evident, I think, from like the first thing you see, which is so inventive and cool.
Yeah, I agree completely. I was on board the moment they did that, the curtains opened, and I loved the really theatrical movement of the maestro.
Totally. Yeah, he's like super demonstrative. Yeah.
Oh yeah, going nuts. It was really fun. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah. And feel free to jump in here anytime. I also the moment when Christian belts out "The Hills Are Alive" when like the Bohemians are like, what should it be? Is like the chaos of it. Like all the alternative lines that they're saying are very funny. Like so obviously wrong and bad. And him belting out "The Hills Are Alive" is like the first moment in the movie where it like kind of wipes the slate clean and it's just like it cuts through everything and it's just really like goosebump inducing great.
Oh yes, man. The whole beginning of the movie is tonally so aggressive in a way.
Yeah.
And so maybe I'll say so confident, which I really liked. And mm-hmm. I was, you know, I did think about this. I wrote down Looney Tunes, which maybe, nice. I don't know if you sort of registered that as well, but I mean, there's just all these sort of goofy sound effects. Mm-hmm. And it's really messy and almost getting toward kind of slapsticky, and it's fun. A couple other things I loved in the intro, I just wrote these down because I was going to take notes, and per usual I took more notes in the beginning than the end. But one thing is Toulouse, I can't pronounce almost how do I pronounce John Leguizamo's last name?
Leguizamo. Got it.
John Leguizamo's character.
His character's last name or John Leguizamo's last name?
No, John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been struggling to say the word materialize recently, by the way. It's a hard word to say. Just something to think about. Materialize.
Materialize. Interesting.
It seems really easy for you. Makes me pretty self-conscious.
No, I have, I've been a word that I was planning on, I am planning on using in the podcast is anachronistic. And so one is kind of, that one's kind of in my, I'm kind of focused on that, but go ahead.
Yeah. Now I used anachronistic recently. That word's pretty easy for me to say and use. But materialize is a real challenge. I think I'm doing well right now. Anyway, so John Leguizamo's character is singing that a very he describes Ewan McGregor's character as a very strange boy. Is that a song that was that song written for this movie? That little sort of melody. Because what I was thinking was it was a funny word to attach to this main character. He's like a very strange boy. Like,
Strange enchanted. Yeah. I don't know. I think nature.
Okay. So it's not. It's Nat King Cole.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was going to say the. Yeah. Now I see that. Yep. Which totally makes sense. Because it's like organically, are you going to like. You know, are the filmmakers going to call, you know, say that he's like a strange boy? Unless it's like a reference to a song that they're going to use.
Yeah. So John Leguizamo's character singing Nature Boy. And in that lyric, the boy is described as being strange. And I just felt that's kind of a funny way to describe this character because otherwise he doesn't really seem strange. Also, in the beginning, they use the word, they describe Satine as a courtesan. And then they quickly define that, which I remember appreciating because I remember when I was 14, I still couldn't really wrap my head around what a courtesan was. And then also another funny thing is 1899. He's like, it was 1899, the summer of love. Is that a real thing? Was 1899 the summer of love?
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I felt like it was a little Alice in Wonderland when he ended upstairs in this sort of theatrical gang and then a little sort of Looney Tunes and slapstick, and I thought it was fun.
For sure. No, I think that like that Looney Tunes hadn't crossed my mind, but that is like totally, you know, one of the things that comes to mind now that you say that. I mean, the style of it, and I will say the first hour of this movie is like like impeccable because it is like so stylistically, like the edits, the sound effects, the different like frame rates, the like zoom ins, the pan, like everything that's happening is so bold and what and like unapologetic. Yeah. And what's interesting is that it definitely, like watching it this time, I'm like, oh, this reminds me of Mad Max, or it reminds me of a George Miller movie.
Interesting.
Who's also, like Baz Luhrmann, a fellow Australian filmmaker. Oh. So I don't know, like the if that is like if they're right. it, like within Australian cinema, if like that kind of that sort of aesthetic and that boldness is like a part of a certain tradition in the cinema from there. But I just found it interesting that both those movies that this reminded me of is also from the same continent.
That's really interesting. That's I hadn't thought of that, but that totally makes sense. It also then connects me to the Nicole Kidman lead. I mean, she was fantastic, or I thought, but you know, I wonder too if there's a little Australian connection there.
For sure. I think, I mean, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Moving along. I mean, similarly, I thought when Christian belts out your song in a very similar fashion, when like Satine is just like really like goofily, just like sort of like, you know, trying to have sex and be seductive in like a really cartoonish way.
Mm-hmm.
And it just builds and builds and builds. And then it just cuts through just with like the most beautiful, like cutting, just like, you know, your song. And like, she just like immediately stops and stares at it. Like, it's just like, it's powerful.
Dude, I agree. I believed it and I loved it.
Yeah.
It was so good. And I love we've sort of quickly already touched on my three favorite scenes, and one is that scene when they're first up in the elephant room and she thinks he's the Duke. I just ended up loving that entire scene. Really long scene from start to finish. That, the elephant love medley, and then the Roxanne tango, I thought were all fantastic, and I was riveted. But yeah, when he explodes into song like that, or erupts into song and sort of it's like and sort of stops her hysteria, not her hysteria, but yeah, her sort of what you were saying.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Similarly, I mean, like, I'll come back to this, but it's true. I mean, truly, it kind of like doesn't have a bad moment in the first hour of the movie. Like, going to Elephant Love Song medley, that whole medley is like, I mean, I don't think I'm alone in just that being like the, like, maybe the best part of the movie, because it's just like the songs they're sampling, the kaleidoscope of it, the imagery, the joy of it, the love, like it's all so good. And particularly when they like build up and break into I Will Always Love You and the sparks fucking fly out of the heart, it's like
amazing
euphoria, man. Euphoria.
Also, for real LOL for me on the moon having a mustache and singing opera. I was like,
dude,
this is, we're not holding anything back with this.
Yes,
yeah,
dude.
I mean, it was, and again, to experience it, experience some of those songs for the first time, just because I didn't listen to a ton of music in high school. I was just primed to be completely bowled over by the music. Yeah, it's beautiful. They also, I love that they, I mean, a testament to the actors probably more than anything, but that she could fall in love within, and he could fall in love within just a few verses of your song was, I mean, they sold it so well, which I thought was exciting and fun.
So well. I'm gonna use this because there's a really great quote on the Wikipedia page from Baz Luhrmann about the kind of inspiration and writing process for the movie that fits into this. So I'm just going to go into it. It's kind of a long quote, but he says, he's talking about the Bollywood influence on Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, do you mind if I eat an apple while you're reading this?
Of course. Closer to the microphone, preferably. There we go. Yes. Some ASMR Honeycrisp as I talk about Baz Luhrmann's inspiration. he says, we went to this huge ice cream picture palace to see a Bollywood movie. Here we were with 2,000 Indians watching a film in Hindi, and there was the lowest possible comedy and then incredible drama and tragedy and then breakout into songs. And it was like 3.5 hours. We thought we had suddenly learned Hindi because we understood everything. We thought it was incredible how involved the audience were, how uncool they were, how their coolness had been ripped aside, and how they were united in the singular sharing of the story. The thrill of thinking, could we ever do that in the West? Could we ever get past that cerebral cool and perceived cool? It required this idea of comic tragedy. Could you make those switches? Fine in Shakespeare, low comedy, and then you die in 5 minutes. In Moulin Rouge, we went further. Our recognizable story, though Orphean in shape, is derived from Camille, La Boheme, whether you know those texts or not, you recognize those patterns and character types. I think that's like that idea of like low comedy and just like high tragedy and high drama, just like the and like song and dance and colors and like just like those broad like kind of juxtaposed things that like feels like that, like totally hearing that is like, oh, that's like totally it, where it's just like, yeah, it's just like lowbrow, highbrow, like it's just so radical and it's everything.
I feel like mission accomplished. I feel like you totally pulled that out. And I was sort of, again, going to the Looney Tunes thing, I just felt like it is amazing how sort of goofy and slapsticky this is. But then maybe to your point, like the way they change the frame rate when they show Satine first sort of coughing and fainting, it really sucks you in and there's a super heavy gravity. So that's fun to hear.
100%.
Yeah.
I also had the moon singing as a favorite moment. And like, similarly, I love it when the gun is knocked away at the end, how it goes and bounces off the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
it's like both of the moon singing and that are just like, so like, you're so right. It's almost like the guy playing the flame throwing guitar in Mad Max, where it's like this, like, oh, like just in case this was unclear, like this is just like a signal of like what this reality is. So like, if you don't like it, like this is what we're about here. So like, take it or leave it, but this is what we're doing.
Yeah, dude. I love the comparison to Mad Max just because the story is so different, but I think you're right. Incidentally, that guitar flamethrower, I've been living home with my mom and stepdad for 5 months. And, I recently showed that to my mom as an impression of her in the morning. Very, very loud in the morning. If you want to ease into your day, you don't want to do it alongside Monica Meredith, which is my loving mother, who I love so much. She got a real kick out of it.
Okay, that's great. So that's not necessarily, because like a flame-throwing guitar, that's not, she's not necessarily angry. It's just like a lot of, it's a lot of like noise.
I want to be crystal clear. She is not angry. She's just, you know, there's just a lot of noise very early. The moment she's up. but you know, there's no anger. There's love and kindness and just a lot of clanging of various things around the house that I think she's like, you know, making coffee and maybe sort of like rearranging some stuff around the house. You know, if you knew my mom, you might find this to be hilarious. But if you don't, you might be able to appreciate that it's kind of funny.
Well, listeners, email in. If you know Mark's mom, let us know. And if you don't, let us know. I like that. That's charming. Just real quick, I really enjoy, as I said before, the Roxanne Tango, the Like a Virgin sequence is great. The Duke, I have to call out, like, the Duke, especially watching it this time, is just phenomenal. He is played by Richard Roxburgh. I may be mispronouncing that last name, but just how much he leans into it, and like his, like, he has so many little moments, like in the Like a Virgin sequence when he like kind of takes the lead in his dancing and like looking towards the camera, and like when he tries to sing, I forget which sequence of your song, but it's just like, right, it's so loud, like, you can tell everybody, and he's off key. It's so like, great.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I feel like he was sort of chan. I feel like he was doing what Johnny Depp was trying to do as Willy Wonka.
Ooh, interesting.
He was just so eccentric and weird. I mean, although definitely much more angrier than Wonka could ever be. I remember being really blown away that he could keep up all of these affects sort of consistently, because they were so strange.
And so, like, so bold and, like, big, yeah.
And then during Like a Virgin, yeah, to see his sort of what felt like sort of singing and dancing chops sort of come to life through the lens, the filter of this, like, total sort of weirdo was exhilarating.
Yes.
And, yeah, I remember, yeah, so I agree. I was sort of like, this guy is so creepy and weird, and I can't believe he's able to keep it up, the specificity of what he's doing for all of the filming.
100%. 100%. Okay, let's, unless you have more, let's move on to some talking points.
Sure.
And I realize I don't really have any, because my one talking point was that this is just like Mad Max, and Babe, Pig in the City for that matter. Which is, yeah, it's just interesting to me that like there's no really other movies that I can think of that have that aesthetic and that sort of like, it feels like the underlying statement of it, whether intentional or not, is like you're all thinking too small. Mm-hmm. Like you're all caught up in like logic and like realism and all this stuff. And like y'all don't realize that you don't need to do that, that you can do anything in movies and it can be incredible. Which needless to say is like super inspiring and I think awesome.
Yes. It felt like somebody correctly taking a Broadway production or putting it into film, and which I don't think was the case. I believe this movie, I think there has since been a Broadway production, but what I mean is it was like taking the sort of spirit of theater and musicals and using the medium of film to really sort of have a creative explosion of color and set pieces and choreography and all that. So yeah, I thought it was super impressive and fun, and they did say, I mean, I think specifically like when he first sings, that when he belts out "My Gift Is My Song," all of the lights of Paris, like it cuts to this huge wide shot of the city and all of the lights in Paris, everybody like wakes up, you know, and it was it's like, yeah, why not? I don't know, it's fun. It seems like they're saying yes to all these fun choices.
Yeah, totally. Kind of on that note, and like kind of this just like I love reading this, where it's like, because it's like, because it is like the way it's categorized on Wikipedia is that it's a jukebox musical romantic drama, which is, I mean, congrats on that. But like the music, I mean, the music is, because it's like anachronistic and like it's like, yeah, whatever, like we don't care, like all this music came out 100 years after like when this movie takes place. But reading this, one of the main reasons for this is because they wanted to make Christian's musical ability to be ahead of his time.
Isn't that fun,
illustrates his musical genius, that the fact that like what he's doing is stuff that's like going to be huge in 100 years, which is like, never would have picked up on that watching this, but like that being kind of the main compass for like why they used all this like, you know, music that comes out a century later, is I fucking love that so much.
That's really cool. I love learning an intention, a smart, cool intention that is played out and not really made explicit in the movie, but translates well for the audience.
For sure. Do you have any talking points?
I have, one thing I wanted to point out is another moment I loved is when they did the shots of Absinthe and the Absinthe Fairy, and like they sort of like guitars sort of started shredding and she was the super sexy Absinthe Fairy. I was like, this is cool and fun. And I think I sort of forgot how kind of sexy the movie is.
It's
because it's all about love. But I thought they, like, I loved that. And I did. Sort of remember, I think when I watched it on wherever I rented it, it was like I think I rented it on Amazon, and one of the
trivia,
I'm sort of pop-up. Blanking here, I think once I started watching it, it showed why it was rated PG-13 and it said like sexual content and stuff. I remember being like, oh, I don't really remember that as much, but it was definitely a sexy movie with some kind of heavy sexual themes. But I did love that Absinthe Fairy moment. I thought it was interesting to rewatch this as having spent 10 years in the arts. Like I really loved when at the end of their pitch to the Duke on the story, they said, on top of your fee, you'll be involved artistically, and just sort of knowing in my bones what that means to a producer or an investor was really fun.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. Totally. And also like the kind of wide-eyedness of Christian as a character, like kind of at the beginning of the movie, and like he moved to Paris to to pursue truth and love and beauty, and like his father being like, this is a constant obsession with love, you know, like that, like watching that as a teenager, I was like, okay. And like watching it now, it's like fun. It's that makes more sense. And is also like, I just felt like that's like, even though that's like so broad, it's so relatable at the same time. Cause it is like, I feel like the underlying, there's different manifestations of that and different coloring of that, but like I feel like generally speaking, for anyone trying to make it in the arts, that is present in some capacity,
big time. I do have a splitting hair. Is it fine to
let's jump into it. We're splitting hairs. What do you got?
So the one thing, so the song Come What May, I think is really, it's really beautiful, especially what it means to the two leads. I did find myself noticing that because this is one of the film's original pieces, I just sort of noticed that the poetry, you know, from the young poet wasn't as good as the poetry coming from, you know, David Bowie or some of these other people. And specifically, I mean, I sort of wrote down because I was just like, okay. And it was like, you know, saying like, there's no mountain too high, no river too wide. You know, like, that's cute, but also just a sort of noticeable drop in this sort of creative poetry for the song. But again, I think it's, you know, I remember really liking the song as a teenager, and I still think it's beautiful for what it is. But, you know, I just sort of noticed, like, you know, this is a level below Your Song or, you know, Dolly Parton's, you know, lyrics and all that. And I just thought it was kind of funny just because it was, you know, no mountain too high, no river too wide.
Sure.
You know, there's that ain't no mountain high. Like, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
That feels a little different. That song is a little better than Come What May.
No, that's fair. I'm trying to remember. Is that the first time that they duet? I mean, I know that like Elephant Love Song melody is kind of when like that's the first time like Satine like kind of comes over and is like, okay, we're going to like, I love you and we can maybe try this. Come What May, I'm trying to remember. Do they duet that? Or is that Ewan McGregor singing that?
For the first time or?
Yeah, I guess it is reprised multiple times. Okay. I was going to try to make the argument that it was like, oh, that was like the first time that they like really full on were singing with each other to each other. So there is this like rawness to it, but I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Well, I think even if there is, it
stood out.
I mean, again, you know, just noticing because they're using these other, you know, mega hits, it was just kind of funny to me. I was like, okay, like they got to have some original. And I think that's pretty common for a lot of movies like this. There's always like an original hit or two, and it's or an original song or two, and it's maybe not quite good as one of the mega hits that they have the rights to and are singing. But, you know, I didn't it against the film. It was just something I thought was kind of funny to notice.
Yeah. Some trivia about Come What May. That is, I believe, the only original song in the movie, and it was originally written for Baz Luhrmann's previous film, Romeo and Juliet, but didn't make the cut.
Oh.
And so they used it in this movie, and it was disqualified from Best Original Song, the Best Original Song Oscar, because technically it was written for a different movie, which is insane.
Wow. That is insane.
Yeah. I like that. Okay, so my splitting hair is kind of... not so much a splitting hair as it is a haircut. But I'm going to say this, and I alluded to it earlier. I realized upon watching it this time that I think the first hour of this movie is perfect. I mean, it's just great. They were like doing the song and dance like da-da-da-da-da-da for the Duke. Like, and I just like kind of like checked where we were at. And I'm like, is this I genuinely thought this. I thought, oh, is this the 20-minute mark? Like, is this the inciting incident? And we were 50 minutes into the movie. And I was like, holy shit, that is the fastest 50 minutes of a movie. Like, wow. I was shocked.
Yeah.
And because like it's like everything we just said, it's just like so, it just immediately starts. You're thrown into it. There's so much energy, like noise, images, colors, sound, like all of this stuff. It's such a cacophony on every sensory level. And it just works and it's beautiful and you get this love story and it's just like, it's so fast and great. And then after they kind of like sell the musical to the Duke, I did find myself the last half of this movie was a little tougher. Aside from the musical numbers, like Rock, Like a Virgin and the Roxanne Tango and the closing number, aside from the musical numbers, the last half of this movie was a little less compelling to me on this watch.
I had the same the same thought was that the movie ultimately felt a little long. I remember looking at, for me, checking a timestamp and being surprised that there were 50 minutes left. I feel like the Act Three could be the production spectacular, which is again extravagant and, you know, dare I say spectacular, but it was long. I mean, I think there was like 35, 40 minutes left in the movie when that started. So I hear what you're saying. I think the El Tango de Roxanne sort of propped up the second half of the movie, and was fabulous. But outside of
it's
that,
just slow.
Just a little slow, just a lot.
For sure. And I will say it's hard to like divorce personal taste from like kind of objective, like what is the, you know, what is, how is the movie actually doing and is it doing it well? I just like, I found it's like the first half of this movie is so exuberant and like hopeful and like full of love and promise. And just to like have that kind of classic tragedy, kind of like forbidden love story that's like, I can't ever see you again and I'm lying to you, you know, the Romeo and Juliet-ness of it. Which like feels like that, you know, that's as much a linchpin of the movie as any other element of it. But
right.
It just, to me, it's like, I don't like this like sad shit. Like, why can't they just like be putting on a production and like, yes, she's like romantically tied to the Duke. But like, what if it's like, what if he's just dumb and doesn't get in? Yes, I mean, that's the emotional or that's the dramatic like motor of the movie. But like, I just found like it just gets so like bogged down and sad, like with like the forbiddenness and will they ever be able to be together stuff. Like I was bummed by it.
Right. Well, it had the iceberg that Titanic has, which is knowing that Satine is sick and likely going to die. For me, I think I'm fine with the sort of sadness and gravity of it all, but it did just feel a little bit long. I'm trying to think of where it could maybe be cut or sped up. But it's sort of also, I don't know if it was just cause it was like 2001 and, you know, pretty much very close to being a 90s movie. Sometimes the sadness felt a little goofy and sappy, you know, with him. But again, because tonally it all fit within the movie, it was fine. You know, just like him in a tank top, presumably drunk, sort of typing away, you know, with one finger, you know, the fingers on his little keypad and stuff, just so depressed. Like that was, that was funny.
Saccharine.
To me.
Oh, funny. Gotcha. Well, I totally hear that. I feel like the way, and this gets into legacy a little bit, but like my perspective on that is sort of like the movie gets away with that because it feels like it's self-aware of all that stuff. It feels like melodrama is part of the aesthetic of this movie. So therefore, like, you know, opening up on him with like a cigarette hanging out of his mouth and like his eyes swollen from crying so much. And like, I loved once, you know, that stuff. It feels like self-aware. So it like gets away with it.
Totally. Yeah. I think they lean into that. It's intentionally, I mean, it's definitely sad, but if, maybe, yeah, in a different film, if you were to just, it could become across a little soapy and melodramatic, but it's fun, I think, as well as sad, but it's stylistically, I think it's fun.
Cool. Any other hairs to split?
Let me see. I took a few notes. No, I should also just mention real quick, I thought the actor, try to find his name, who was playing the MC, I think he's just fantastic. Slughorn, isn't he Slughorn, I think?
He's Slughorn, his name. And he actually won the Best Supporting Actor this year for a different movie.
Oh, cool.
Jim Broadbent.
Jim Broadbent. I thought he just...
Excellent.
Was excellent, yeah.
Yes.
So shout out to Jim Broadbent.
100%. Yeah, he won the best supporting actor for a movie called Iris from the same year.
Yeah. Oh, the same year? Did you say he won the same
year? Same year, 2001.
Wow.
Yep.
Great year for him.
Yeah.
Wow.
He did win a British Academy Award for his performance in this film as Zeidler.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know there were British Academy Awards. No offense. Britain. Cool. Okay. So, real quick before we get to MVP, I just want to go over some trivia, and I kind of have dispersed it piecemeal over the course of this episode, but one thing I haven't said yet is that this was originally slated for a December 2000 release, and it was going to be 20th Century Fox's big, like, kind of tentpole award contender, but then Baz Luhrmann needed an extension on it to finish stuff up, so it got pushed to May of 2001, which is interesting.
Oh, yeah, that is interesting.
Also, the Green Fairy, the sexy Green Fairy, who is Kylie Minogue.
Oh, awesome.
I didn't know if you knew that piece of trivia. No. Yeah, that's Kylie Minogue as the Tinkerbell Green Fairy. It was originally supposed to be a long-haired muscle man with a giant sitar, and it was going to be played by Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh,
and
that could have been good, too.
That could have been good, too. Yeah, totally different. And Osbourne still gives voice to the fairy's guttural scream when it turns evil. Pretty incredible. Nice. Pretty incredible. Cool. That's all the trivia that I have. I was really... Oh, here's one. DiCaprio auditioned for the role of Christian.
Unbelievable.
And he obviously played the lead in Baz Luhrmann's previous film, Romeo and Juliet, which Max and I have referenced on this podcast as if we ever do 1996, we will be covering Romeo and Juliet because that movie... friggin' rules. This is Moulin Rouge is the final part of Luhrmann's Red Curtain trilogy, which Strictly Ballroom was his debut film. Romeo and Juliet was the follow-up, and then Moulin Rouge was his third film. And so those are all considered as part of a thematic trilogy called the Red Curtain trilogy, which I didn't know. I've never seen Strictly Ballroom. I think Guy Pearce is in it.
I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, I remember seeing like the DVD cover at Barnes & Noble, but I've never watched it. I wonder if it's great. It might be great. Might be like an early great one. Let's move on to MVP. And as always, the MVP has to be singular, and it can be just like an element. It can be like the soundtrack or the production design, but it does have to be singular. Do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I think I'm going to give it to Nicole Kidman.
Okay.
I thought she carried the mantle. I believe that's the phrase.
I'm not sure, but yeah.
I just thought she was great. And part of me loved, like, I don't know if this sort of song and dance is her background, but and maybe it is, but especially in that first scene where she thinks that Christian is the Duke, and then afterward the gang of the and then Bohemians? Afterward when all the other actors show up and are sort of dancing around, I remember thinking it was kind of funny that you have all these like other sort of no names, and then you have this megastar Nicole Kidman dancing along with them. So I thought she was great. Again, she convinced me that she had fallen in love with Christian after this one song. And
yeah,
I thought she
definitely
sort of really carried the emotional up and downs, and was at times really light and sort of funny and entertaining, and could, but then also, I mean, just so carried the gravity of the downs. And but then I did love Jim Broadbent in this. I mean, his character was kind of a skeezy shithead, but I thought he was just so good.
You love
and
him.
I
love
whenever he was on screen. So
yeah,
maybe I might even change this to say Jim Broadbent. I just thought he was, it was such a, like an unusual but great big, and also really goofy. I was like amazed at how goofy these people pulled it off. It reminds me of Anthony Hopkins talking about how you have to lean into some of the cheesiness of the lines of Hannibal Lecter. But I felt like these people were not holding anything back in their sort of hysteric mania, and it was fun.
I love that. All right. Jim Broadbent, Mark Denny's MVP for Moulin Rouge. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. That one feels like a nice, like under the radar sort of choice, and it's good.
Yeah.
I have the opposite of that. I feel like the most obvious choice, which is Baz Luhrmann, just because like his blood kind of flows through every part of this movie. And it is like the most, like, I feel like saying his name as MVP is like the most, like, being like, the MVP of Moulin Rouge is Moulin Rouge. but nevertheless, I think, cause it's just like the direction, the everything about it, is just like, really, it feels like of the things that Baz Luhrmann, that come to mind when someone says Baz Luhrmann, I feel like Moulin Rouge encapsulates those and like maybe the best example of all of those things. So I gotta go Baz for MVP. Nice. Moulin Rouge.
Cool. Yeah. Well, the man had a vision and he saw it through.
Certainly did. Yeah. Certainly did.
And it was God a big vision. And again, I think when you have a huge vision like that, I'm always impressed when you can be consistent all the way through.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, I think he was.
And again, not nominated for Best Director in 2001, which is incredible. Okay, so real quick, I have a special category because this kind of occurred to me, and I think this movie, Moulin Rouge, is particularly well suited for this. And this category is, if this movie was a Muppet movie, which Muppet would play which role? And I mean, I feel like the obvious ones, Kermit is a great Christian. Mm. Miss Piggy is Satine.
Mm.
Great. I think Fozzie plays Ziedler.
Okay.
I think Sam Eagle might be the Duke.
Definitely.
And then I think Gonzo plays Henry de Toulouse-Lautrec.
Nice.
And that's all I got. But I think like even like the group of Bohemians, like it's like you can have like the Muppet who throws the fishes. Mm. Right. You can have, I mean Gonzo. Oh, Gonzo. But you can have like Rizzo. You can have Pepe. Like you can have all those guys in the Bohemians. Like it just feels like it's rich in its in like, you know, the Muppets would, I think, take a really nice bite out of this movie.
I like that. And I'm agreeing with you because I sadly do not. I barely know the Muppet world. And
that's fine.
So I'm going to trust you with these picks, and I'm going to support you. In the picks. So yeah,
thank you.
I think I'm completely aligned.
That means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Lastly, legacy. Mm. What are your thoughts?
It's a tough one. I'm probably just because I haven't really thought about it as much as I should.
Well,
but
because we kind of got the conversation started with like our immediate knee jerk reaction to having this movie on the podcast today, which was like. And I do feel like this is maybe reflective of the general place, its general place kind of in culture, but it's like, it was very popular at the time, really well respected, loved at the time. And it's just been a while since I've like seen the movie, heard it referenced. Maybe I've heard it referenced here and there. But it really kind of has, it's kind of its time and like not the forefront of conversation. It's like a reference point now. I think it's looked back on with a lot of love and uh-huh. a lot of justified love, but it's just not something that's like, hey, let's pop in Moulin Rouge. Sense I get. Yeah.
I love the idea of just popping in Moulin Rouge. So what are we doing tonight? Should we pop in Moulin Rouge?
But
I mean, I think for me, maybe the legacy is just the really swinging for the fences in a movie and taking a lot of creative risks. I don't mm-hmm. know. I'm not super familiar with this genre of sort of movie musicals. Mm-hmm. But I have to believe, and I would hope that it inspired other filmmakers to take similar creative leaps. And, mm-hmm. Like you said, just sort of go for it. Whatever you think is fun. I mean, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah, and going back to like popping in Moulin Rouge, I do think there was a time, certainly like maybe mid-2000s, where, hey, let's pop it. We're popping in Moulin Rouge was definitely something that was said often. Mm. Or this was definitely like in the like, wow. What are we watching tonight? We're going to pop this in. Because there is something I think like with like a movie's like recency, like we'll say like 5-ish years, or at least when DVDs, even with DVDs, when DVDs were like the main way of watching movies at home, like it's like there was a time where it's like if it's recent, like you're just going to pop it in. And and for whatever reason, like the farther you get away from a movie with some outliers notwithstanding, it just like you just it stops because it becomes weird to like want to watch those movies. It's just like there's a natural kind of recency sort of bias where it's like I think part of it is like you want to feel. Because it's like somewhat recent, you feel connected, but like the older a movie is, the more isolating it may feel to watch it, you know, because you're like, am I the only one watching this movie from the 1950s, you know, right. I do feel like there's a more connected feeling when you're watching the more recent something is that you're watching.
Oh yeah. Well, it's just like everybody's thinking about it and knows mm-hmm. about it and has enjoyed it, especially if you're, I mean, were you popping in Moulin Rouge with friends or like with a girlfriend or something?
I mean, if I'm being honest, it was by myself probably. Nice. I was probably okay. in my dorm room, my one person dorm room, and just yeah. popping it in. Yeah. So I guess that is different. Cause it's like, yeah, if you're watching something with friends, that's totally completely different.
I was sort of imagining a group of like 12 people hanging out in one room, trying to figure out what movie to put on. And it's like, should we pop something on? The Dark Knight, Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, even saying that now of like being in a room with 12 people and the idea that you're going to pop in a movie feels like a very, that I've not been in that situation in a long time. And I'm not even talking about quarantine. I'm just like talking about like, I feel like that's a rare thing to do anymore. I guess like you put, maybe you throw on something like agreeable on Netflix, like sometimes at parties. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a chance that I've actually never been in that situation. And I was just imagining it purely as a hypothetical. I think when you have 12 people all together, the idea of trying to get a movie that everybody wants to watch sounds difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have trouble doing it with like 3 or 4 people.
Yeah. It's got to be the broadest sort of like most agreeable thing.
Right. Got to be a Will Ferrell movie that everybody loves.
Yeah.
God, you know, I'm speaking from experience here. This is, wait, what'd you say? Or National Treasure?
No, unintentionally, I was like, you said Will Ferrell and I said, God bless that National Treasure. But then I feel like National Treasure is a movie that, you know, it's going to appeal to at least half of the 12 that you're hanging with.
Yes. And I brought up Will Ferrell because I was trying to find a movie to watch with my brother, mom, and stepdad. And, my brother Sean had seen everything. My mom was like pretty fine with stuff. My stepdad, Dean, can get bored quickly, so we settled on Step Brothers, a Will Ferrell movie that everybody can enjoy. And also, I shouldn't call it a Will Ferrell movie, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly movie. And also Adam McKay. Adam McKay and mm-hmm. Adam Scott. Is a great movie.
Yeah, totally. This is a really nice test because it's almost like, do you know anyone who doesn't like Will Ferrell?
No.
Because my uncle doesn't find Will Ferrell funny.
Who does he find funny? Go ahead, sorry.
My uncle is a very funny person. Like, he's a funny, witty, funny guy. Mm-hmm. Loves Eddie Murphy, kind of like our parents' generation's, like, kind of stars. Like, he finds, I mean, I don't want to speak for him, but like, I mean, I Chevy Chase, Bill okay. Murray. I think he probably likes Steve Martin. Now I'm just kind of hypothesizing. I don't know. Yeah. He likes Jim Carrey. But he's the only person that I can think of that I know that doesn't like Will Ferrell, which is interesting because like thinking about that now, it's like Will Ferrell is universally beloved. I mean, he really is. Is there someone more universally beloved than Will Ferrell?
I think Dolly Parton.
That's good. That's a really good. But she's like, that's like a notable thing with her is how like, the what do you call that? The cross-section appeal. I'm butchering this. What is it?
Yes, I don't know, but it is. I mean, I'm taking this from that podcast. I think it's called Dolly's America, where it's. Yeah. I think it was like almost an intentional strategy. But that sounds like that sounds negative, I think.
Malicious, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's not, like naturally.
Yeah.
Like but she's,
I think,
yeah.
Yeah. Maybe she started to, I think also maybe she started to take a little bit more of a political stance. So maybe Will Ferrell would reclaim the throne. I don't know if Will Ferrell's especially political. It seems like he could be.
He's expressed political. Life. Yeah. Especially when he was like, when he was doing the You're Welcome America, like Broadway, George Bush.
Yeah. Right.
Thing. I mean, it's like And Adam McKay is like one of the most outspoken political figures, I feel like, in Hollywood. But also Will Ferrell distanced himself from Adam McKay. Or they like kind of said,
oh, really?
They sell the production company. But I don't know. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I do know Will Ferrell didn't want to meet Bush because he didn't want to have to feel sort of self-conscious about taking shots at him. So.
Oh, interesting. I thought he didn't want to meet Bush because he didn't like he disagreed with how he like handled everything.
Yes. I think it was both, and actually primarily what you're saying, but, and I think, so I mean, like, he didn't want to be self-conscious because he wanted to be able to be critical of what
he
was doing.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Interesting. Great. All right. Well, we are over time, so we got to wrap it up. Thank you so much for listening. Please hit the subscribe button on your podcast player. And if you have a moment and enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left us a review. We'd love to hear from you as well. If you agree with us, disagree with us, or have your own hot takes, send us an email or voice memo to theoscarwent2@gmail.com. And if we think you're onto something, we'll play it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you have a film you'd like us to talk about, shoot us an email and tell us why you love or hate that movie, and we'll consider it for our next deep dive. Remember, we're doing 2001, so as long as it's released in the calendar year of 2001, it is eligible. Mark, I mean, Max isn't gonna like this, but Max is out. You're now the official co-host.
Awesome.
Joking.
Sorry, I'm just getting back into my Apple.
Yeah, no. I love apples. No, just kidding. But Mark, as in the first time, an absolute pleasure talking with you. We appreciate you taking the time. Love having you on. Heck, we may even have you back.
Wow, I would love that.
Yeah, and we'll be in the same room.
Oh,
potentially,
damn.
If that happens, be awesome. Because we'll both live in New York, and COVID is, knock on wood, losing steam.
I think it is.
Yeah, hopefully. All right, Mark, any last words, any last parting thoughts that you want to impart on our listeners?
No.
Okay, until then, the balcony is closed.